Welcome back to Audio Notes. I'm Dmitria Tappan.
And I'm Haeyeon Park, and we are excited to guide you through the fourth program of the Music in Menlo 2025 season, Constellations Ensemble Magic, the program titled Quintessential Quintets.
In the words of David Finkel, the early string quintets on this program reflect the passions of their composers. Mozart, the avid violist eager to join the ensemble, and Boccherini, the cello virtuoso who shaped his music around his own instrument. These pioneering works stand alongside Romantic-era quintets, revealing how the form evolved and deepened over time.
This program showcases the magic of five voices working together. From string quintets, with their warmth, unified timbres, to clarinet and piano quintets, which offer striking contrast in sound and texture.
We begin with Mozart's string quintet in B-flat major, a bright, graceful work that already hints at the emotional depth and complexity he would later bring to the form. Next comes Weber's clarinet quintet, written in a style that often feels almost like a concerto. Boccherini's Musica Notturna delle Strade di Madrid paints a colorful and whimsical picture of Madrid's bustling streets at night, blending folk rhythms with refined, inventive string writing.
And finally, we close with Saint-Saëns' Piano Quintet, a sweeping, dramatic work that captures the expressive range of romantic chamber music, moving effortlessly between tenderness, intensity, and excitement.
We begin with Mozart's youthful string quintet in B-flat major. This charming work was composed in 1773, when Mozart was just 17 years old. In fact, this quintet remains one of the composer's earliest pieces regularly performed today. At the time of its composition, Mozart was yet to write all of the so-called standard pieces he is known for, the standard violin sonatas, or piano trios frequently heard in concert halls today. And his celebrated mature string quartets were still nearly a decade away. Remarkably ambitious for its youthful creator, the B-flat major quintet exceeds the scale of Mozart's earlier childhood works, unfolding in an expansive four-movement structure that spans nearly half an hour. It offers an insightful glimpse into the emerging genius of a composer who was demonstrating profound mastery and expressive sophistication. The quintet is thought to have been inspired by earlier string quintets scored for two violins, two violas, and cello composed by Michael Haydn, a friend of Mozart and younger brother of composer Joseph Haydn. Today, however, Mozart himself is widely recognized as the pivotal figure who popularized and perfected the two-viola string quintet instrumentation. By adding a second viola to the standard string quartet, Mozart not only capitalized on his own deep affection for an instrument he frequently played, but also enriched the ensemble's texture, creating inner voices capable of greater freedom, intricate interplay, as well as exceptional subtlety and complexity. In total, Mozart went on to compose six string quintets featuring two violas, including the celebrated quintets in C major and G minor, both of which achieved the revered pinnacle status in the world of chamber music. Following Mozart's lead, the two-viola quintet became a lasting format, time and time again embraced by later composers such as Beethoven, Mendelssohn, Dvorak, Bruckner, and Brahms, and many more all the way to today. We asked violist Paul Neubauer to share his thoughts about Mozart's B-flat quintet.
The wonderful thing about the Mozart B-flat quintet is that it's so rarely heard, because we normally hear the most famous quintets. The G minor, perhaps, is the most famous, and the C major is another one, and the E-flat. Yes, these are all keys that may not mean anything to anybody, but the B-flat quintet is very interesting because it was done at such a young age. We all know that Mozart was a very precocious composer, writing incredible works at a young age. And this quintet is so mature for someone so young as he was. And it's delightful. It has a quite an operatic quality. So you see a lot of future Mozart in its writing. And honestly, I've only played it a few times. And whenever I've played the B flat, it's always like, why isn't this played more often? It's such a delightful, wonderful piece with so much to offer.
The first movement, Allegro Moderato, begins with a cheerful and engaging melody played by the first violin, with all the other instruments mainly in supporting roles, providing a pulse. After the first violin completes its initial statement, the first viola takes over, restating the theme. The second theme features a graceful dialogue between the first and second violins, playing exactly an octave apart. However, one of the movement's striking harmonic surprises occurs immediately following this second theme. After a dramatic pause of complete silence, the two lowest instruments enter unexpectedly with ominous octaves, shifting the atmosphere dramatically. The development section of this movement is characterized by rich contrapuntal textures, as rapid triplet figures pass dynamically among all the instruments, creating a compelling sense of drama and forward momentum. Following the standard sonata allegro form, this grand opening movement concludes with a quick recap of all the characters. Mozart is just so amazing at packing so many ideas in such a short time. Listen to the folksy repeated note conversation. It will reappear in the last movement. The ominous unison figure in the strings, the rising assertive scale, the lingering questioning violin and viola motives, and the boisterous triplets driving to the end. The second movement, Adagio, begins with all five instruments playing consordino with mutes, creating an immediate sense of ethereal intimacy. It opens with gestures in unison octaves, so simple. Yet there's something magical about this idea. It feels stately and proper, yet at the same time clever and subtly witty. You can almost imagine a cheeky smile on Mozart's face as these few notes unfold. Just moments later, it is revealed that this figure is actually an accompaniment to a beautiful soaring aria introduced by the first violin, a theme that could easily have found its place in one of Mozart's operas. The two violas gently assert themselves, offering witty commentary on the main melodic line. The second violin takes over the melody, though this only becomes clear when the first violin joins an imitation a few bars later. A delicate conversation then develops between the first violin and first viola, weaving a tapestry of subtle interplay. The surprises in the details are endless, yet everything remains cloaked in a gentle, lilting sophistication, a tranquil elegance full of tender expressiveness. This is Mozart's genius at its very finest. Let's listen in. And let us hear again from Paul Neubauer.
A beautiful adagio with the solos being passed around to the various instruments and a lot of sort of virtuosic passages in a very slow tempo. And such an operatic composer, everything he writes has the operatic feel. Because look at all the great operas that Mozart wrote. It was in his blood. It was everywhere around him.
The third movement, Minuetto ma Allegretto, opens with a simple yet elegant and pleasing theme. A charming musical dialogue between the first violin and first viola reappears here, echoing their earlier interplay. In the contrasting trio section, Mozart employs a clear and distinctive grouping of instruments. You'll hear the first violin and first viola present a theme in brave, confident tones, with gentle echoes from second violin and second viola, all supported by the cello. It's very on the nose, yet so logical and effective. The final movement, Allegro, is lively and bright, brimming with energy. After the opening witty, graceful melody in the first violin, with its slightly silly repeated notes, a rich contrapuntal texture unfolds among all five instruments, amplifying the movement's vitality, similar to how Mozart employed contrapoint in the development section of the first movement. Once again, we face endless invention. In the second theme, Mozart playfully reverses the expected order. The first viola introduces the theme, and only afterwards does the violin restate it. This might well be Mozart's subtle wink to his fellow violist, and the reversal cleverly highlights the distinctive voices of each instrument. Listen again to how many characters Mozart manages to pack in just a few seconds. Sudden stops and starts, laughing commenting figures, a surprising abrupt entrance from the viola. This is pure comedic theater, showing off Mozart's skills as a dramatist. Throughout, Mozart blends humor, elegance, and rhythmic sparkle. Let's hear what violist Paul Neubauer has to say about this movement and the viola quintet formation in general.
The last movement is quite virtuosic, with lots of running 16th note passages, which are the very quick notes, and that's for all the players. And, you know, when we think about the quintets, most violists and a lot of string players call them the viola quintets because they're two violas. And why are there two violas? What happens when we add the extra viola is that we have more inner voice. And this gives the piece an extra depth, perhaps. And of course, as we all know, Mozart was a violist. So in a lot of the works that Mozart wrote the viola part, quite often we would assume that he was playing one of the parts. So in this case, he could have been playing either the first or second viola part. And because of that, the writing of Mozart for the viola always has something of interest. Not that other composers don't give the viola interesting things, but Mozart gives beautiful melodies and beautiful supporting figures. And what can I say? It's Mozart.
This quintet is such a perfect way to start our program. Delightful, elegant, and so masterful in blending five string voices into a genre-defining masterpiece.
The friendship between composer Carl Maria von Weber and clarinetist Heinrich Joseph Behrmann was one of the most important relationships in the history of the clarinet. Carl Maria von Weber, born in 1786, is remembered today as the father of romantic opera, especially for his groundbreaking Der Freischütz. He was a masterful melodist and orchestrator. While traveling across Germany in 1811, composing and conducting, Weber met the legendary clarinet virtuoso Heinrich Joseph Behrmann, who was 2 years his senior, first in Darmstadt and again a few months later in Munich. The two brilliant minds connected immediately and became lifelong friends. Behrmann, who played a 10-key clarinet, one of the new improved wind instruments of the time, capable of greater range and dynamic nuance, shared with Weber the musical and technical possibilities of this advanced clarinet. Inspired, Weber quickly composed his clarinet concertino opus 26 to showcase Behrmann's remarkable skills. The piece was such a sensation that Weber went on to write four more works for Behrmann: two full concertos, a grand duo concertante with piano, and the clarinet quintet. Completed in 1815 in Prague, the quintet takes its model from Mozart's great clarinet quintet. Yet while Mozart's work artfully blends the clarinet and string quartet as equal partners, Weber's quintet is almost a miniature concerto, with the clarinet dazzling at center stage, supported by the strings. Here's our clarinetist, Sebastian Mantz.
Very interesting about Weber's clarinet quintet is that he didn't write every movement in a row. So it took actually about 4 or 5 years to complete this work. So it was not a commissioned work, but he intended to write it for Heinrich Josef Behrmann, to his clarinetist. But it was kind of an inner urge. He had the feeling he wanted to write this piece originally as a clarinet concerto. But then it turns out, okay, it was just for fun. And this is how the piece also sounds like. So every single movement could stay for itself. It could stand for itself as one piece.
This work leans towards romantic ideals, embracing greater technical demands and heightened emotional contrasts. It is truly a virtuoso showcase, featuring an elaborately crafted clarinet part filled with brilliant passage work, a testament to Weber's gift for melodic invention and theatrical flair. The first movement, Allegro, begins quietly in the strings before the clarinet enters with genial grace. Yet soon, the clarinet takes off into fast, soaring figures, quickly becoming the center of attention. The second theme group is where the clarinet truly shines, unleashing restless, virtuosic passage work. It is virtuosic, but also playful, with rapid runs and graceful arpeggios. The slow movement, titled Fantasia, meaning fantasy, serves as the emotional counterbalance of the quintet, showing off the clarinet's darker tonal colors. It unfolds freely, with the clarinet singing long, expressive lines over gentle swells from the strings. In the middle section, where you feel the sunshine warmth, the clarinet twice interrupts itself to introduce a pair of contrasting chromatic scales, one as loud as possible and the other pianissimo, rising in one quick breath from low D to the B flat, almost three octaves above. Here, Weber shifts harmonies very unexpectedly, and the string textures create a dreamlike atmosphere. This movement is the best example of Weber's operatic approach with the clarinet's expressive solo lines. The third movement, marked Minuetto Capriccio Presto, is a minuet only in name. It is much more capriccio and definitely very presto. It is fast, whimsical, and unpredictable. Far more a scherzo than a traditional dance. The clarinet darts through quicksilver passages while the strings provide a spirited, playful accompaniment. A joking, lighthearted atmosphere prevails, and you can clearly hear the clarinet laughing wholeheartedly in many passages. Here's what our clarinetist, Sebastian Mantz, says about this particular movement.
The third movement, it was the last movement he wrote. It's a joke, actually. a dialogue between the solo clarinet and the cello part. So they're having a discussion, a conversation, and you can make it sound like a joke, yeah, this piece. So what I'm going to try in my performance is to make the audience laugh. In a good way, of course.
The finale, Rondo Allegro Giocoso, is a joyful and effervescent rondo, bursting with charm and humor. The clarinet shines with rapid scales, trills, and sparkling leaps, while the strings engage in lively, animated exchanges. The galloping rhythm is reminiscent of Rossini's William Tell Overture. The lightness and dance-like character bring the quintet to a brilliant, uplifting close. Our clarinetist, Sebastian Mantz, says this movement might be the most virtuosic clarinet writing Weber ever composed.
Fourth movement, he exaggerates even more the role of the virtuosic clarinet. the clarinet player is the boss. And this is maybe just an understatement if you listen to the last movement. So the clarinet is stealing the show.
Weber's clarinet quintet is often considered a bridge between the classical tradition of Mozart's quintet and the full-blooded romantic works of later composers like Brahms. While the piece follows a classical outline, its virtuosic writing, operatic drama, and expressive freedom are hallmarks of the emerging romantic aesthetic. It remains a favorite among clarinetists today for its brilliant display of both technical prowess and lyrical sensitivity.
Weber's second clarinet concerto was the reason why I wanted to learn the clarinet, especially the recording with Benny Goodman. It was on a compilation CD somebody gave me when I was very young. I don't know who gave me that CD. So I was very impressed by the energy of this piece. And of course, you know, Benny Goodman as a jazz musician, he just played it without hesitation. That's the reason why I love Weber, Mozart, Bach. But then comes Weber, because he's so important for us clarinetists. Without him, we wouldn't have the repertoire we have today. You know, Brahms, of course, Brahms was inspired by Mozart, but we got plenty of great repertoire just because of Weber and all the other composers to come.
And now we continue with the quintet by Luigi Boccherini. Born in 1743 in Lucca, Italy, Boccherini hailed from a deeply musical family. His father, Leopoldo Boccherini, was a cellist and double bass player, and his brother, Giovanni Gastone, was a poet and dancer who collaborated with composers like Antonio Salieri and Joseph Haydn. Luigi received his initial musical training from his father, and by the age of 13, he was already recognized as a cello virtuoso and continued his studies in Rome before embarking on concert tours across Europe. In 1770, Boccherini entered the service of Infante Luis Antonio, the brother of King Charles III of Spain. When the Infante was exiled to Arenas de San Pedro, Boccherini accompanied him, spending much of his career composing in relative seclusion. Boccherini holds a special place in music history as one of the true pioneers of the string quintet. While the string quartet flourished under composers like Haydn, Boccherini expanded the ensemble by adding an extra cello, rather than the more typical second viola used by Mozart, as in the first piece on this program. Boccherini created a distinctive texture that allowed the cello to really shine. As a virtuoso cellist himself, Boccherini took full advantage of this format, writing over 100 string quintets that explore the instrument's capabilities in ways unmatched by his contemporaries. Let us hear from cellist Nicholas Kandelakis about Boccherini's cello quintet setting.
I think by adding a second cello to a string quartet, you can elevate the role of the cello to a solo instrument, almost to being an equal with the first violin, because you can have a second cello that still provides the bass line as the cello normally does in the string quartet traditionally, but it frees up the first cello. So I can imagine a soloist, a star like Boccherini, wanting to sit in with a pre-established quartet, perhaps a quartet that's affiliated with the court, and kind of essentially solo with them, you know, use them to show off what he can do.
This particular quintet, nicknamed Musica Notturna delle Strade di Madrid, or Night Music of the Streets of Madrid, is one of the most charming and evocative works composed around 1780. Boccherini draws directly on the sounds and atmosphere of Madrid's nighttime street scenes, weaving in Spanish rhythms, dances, and folk elements in this compact 15-minute piece. Here is Nicholas Kandelakis again.
This particular quintet, the Musica Notturna, it's one of his more evocative chamber music pieces. It really sort of tells a story. It really, really paints this picture of I would say, his perception of, I guess, life in Spain. You have a lot of evocation of the guitar. from the group. These incredible pizzicato moments that really are supposed to emulate Spanish guitar. There's a real kind of almost like street musician folk element to the piece that I think does make it rather unique in his output. I mean, this piece is, I want to say the word programmatic, but maybe that's not the right word. It's because it's not necessarily telling a specific story, but it's really emulating things and people that you might hear in this picture. It's like an oral painting where you see trumpets and street musicians and animals walking on the street and birds and Spanish guitar and just this depiction of nightlife in Spain.
The quintet unfolds in a series of short, distinctive, and colorful movements, each portraying a different scene or musical gesture of Madrid. The first movement, the Ave Maria bell, the soldier's drum, begins with the four lower instruments plucking open strings to imitate the tolling of the church bell, followed by the first violin playing repeated notes, mimicking a folk drum. Second movement, Minuet of the Blind Man, instructs the cellists to place their instruments on their knees and strum them like guitars, with the direction to play con mala grazia, with clumsy grace. Third movement, Rosary, the Spaniards Enjoy the Streets, is a contemplative violoncello duet representing the quiet recitation of the Rosary. The fourth movement, Pasacalla of the Street Singers, portrays the street performers known as Los Manolos, strolling guitarists captured through pizzicato and rolling string effects. The final movement, Retreat, the Soldier's Drum, closes the piece with a depiction of the marching soldiers of the Night Watch. The work was never published during Boccherini's lifetime. Maybe he feared that if it were, it wouldn't be understood outside of Spain. In his manuscript, Boccherini wrote, everything that does not comply with the rules of composition may be forgiven for the sake of portraying the scene with veracity. The piece was finally published, believe it or not, in 1921. Before we move on, let us hear once again from Nicholas Kanellakis about what it's like to play Boccherini's music as a cellist.
I think there's something wonderful about playing Boccherini as a cellist. Most composers were keyboardists, and you see how that relates to their virtuosic writing for the piano. What's ironic, you know, is that sometimes you play a cello part in Beethoven, in a Beethoven quartet, or in the septet, let's say, or one of Mozart's quartets, and the cello part is so monstrously difficult, but it doesn't sound difficult, and that's the most upsetting thing about them, is that they're not supposed to sound difficult, and they are because as genius as those guys were, they weren't cellists, and they didn't quite know whether it fit well into the hand. In Boccherini's case, occasionally, it sounds incredibly virtuosic and difficult, but is so well written for the cello that sometimes it actually ends up being easier than these passages by these other genius composers who weren't cellists. So that is an interesting thing about as a cellist playing a composer like Boccherini. You can show off, but it's so well written for cello that actually it can work quite naturally.
The final piece on our Quintessential Quintets program is the Piano Quintet by the French composer Camille Saint-Saëns. After all, what would a quintet-themed concert be without a piano quintet? This genre, which pairs a string quartet with a piano, was first truly established in 1842 by Robert Schumann, whose groundbreaking piano quintet in E-flat major set the standard for generations to come. Since then, composers such as Brahms, Dvorak, Elgar, and Shostakovich have brought their own national colors and personal voices to the form. The piano quintet has become a cornerstone of the chamber music repertoire, capable of truly symphonic breadth in its incredible variety of means and textures. At times it can sound like a string quartet, at others like a piano concerto. Now it imitates the woodwind section, and now it creates triumphant, brass-filled majesty. Camille Saint-Saëns composed his piano quintet in A minor in 1855, at the age of just 20. Already a celebrated prodigy in Paris, both as a superb pianist and a remarkably gifted composer, Saint-Saëns wrote this work at a time when French chamber music was still overshadowed by its German counterparts. While much of the French musical world remained focused on opera, Saint-Saëns sought to elevate and promote the chamber music tradition in France. This quintet was one of the earliest efforts in that mission. Though earlier French composers like Louis Ferenc and Georges Anslow had written piano quintets in the 1840s, Saint-Saëns' quintet is often recognized as the first major path-breaking French contribution to the genre. Ambitious in its scale, the piece firmly aligns Saint-Saëns with the legacy of Schumann and is looking forward to the contribution of Brahms, for which the world would still need to wait another 10 years. In this first major foray into chamber music, Saint-Saëns gives a central and often commanding role to the piano, a natural choice for a composer who was also one of the great virtuosos of his time. The first movement, Allegro moderato e maestoso, opens with dramatic, weighty piano chords punctuated by eerie, sustained string entries, a striking introduction that evokes the grandeur of a Bach organ prelude. This resemblance is no coincidence. At just 18, Saint-Saëns had been appointed organist at the Church of Sainte-Marie in Paris, and the influence of the organ can be felt throughout the quintet. The solemn opening gestures with their bold chords and long string lines introduce thematic material that will recur throughout the work, giving the quintet a cyclical structure. Thank you. just like that, the music shifts gears. We move into a watery flowing texture that feels almost weightless. It's hard not to think of the aquarium from Carnival of the Animals when you hear this section. It has the same shimmering aquatic atmosphere. A contrasting second theme appears a little later, this time in F major. It's played high in the strings, very softly, and it sounds almost angelic. There's a sense of lightness, like the music is floating. But the calm doesn't last. When those opening chords come back in the coda, the music reaches its most dramatic and turbulent moment. The strings return with the majestic theme, now played fortissimo, while the piano boils underneath in rolling arpeggios. And then, at the very end, Saint-Saëns gives us one last surprise. The movement ends not in minor, but in a major chord. It's a classic Picardy third, a device often used in Baroque music. For someone steeped in that tradition, like Saint-Saëns, it's a fitting touch. The second movement, Andante Sostenuto, offers a striking contrast to the drama of the first. It opens with a noble chorale-like theme in the piano, almost like a prayer, which is then answered by the strings. One detail to listen for is the chromatic figure in the accompaniment. It appears beneath a singing, cantabile melody in the middle of the movement. It might sound like a passing texture, but it's actually important. That chromatic idea will return in the next movement, tying the work in a cyclical way. The third movement, Presto, starts without a pause, and it bursts in with rapid, virtuosic piano runs that immediately create a sense of nervous energy. What's fascinating is that this opening gesture is directly borrowed from the chromatic figure we just heard in the second movement, but here it's transformed, placed in a new register with a new tempo and dynamic. It takes on an entirely different character. This is a brilliant display of lightness and virtuosity, and it's hard not to think of Mendelssohn and his famously nimble scherzos. This is chamber music at its most collaborative, a tightly woven musical fabric that demands agility and precision from all five players. There is another brilliant cyclic moment at the very end of the third movement. The bold opening chords from the first movement come back, this time layered over the same murmuring chromatic figure we've heard in both the second and third movements. And just like the first movement, this one ends with a shift to the major. After such a dark and relentless ride, it's a meaningful moment of relief. The final movement, Allegro assai ma tranquillo, opens in A major and brings the whole work together through a dramatic, cyclic return of earlier material. It's a great example of Saint-Saëns' structural mastery, especially impressive considering how young he was when he wrote this piece. The movement begins with a long fugato passage, built on a rising scale-like theme played by the strings alone. The cello starts it off with a gentle rising and falling gesture, and the other instruments enter one by one. It's a patient and carefully built fugato, and it becomes the main theme of the movement. This leads directly into a beautiful, almost fantasy-like second theme. middle section of the movement becomes highly contrapuntal. At one point, you can actually hear the fugato theme and the second theme happening at the same time. Listening to all the intricate textures in this final movement, it almost feels like Saint-Saëns is deliberately paying tribute to the German tradition, drawing on inspiration from composers like Bach, but filtered through his own very French sense of color and timbre. The movement explores a wide range of emotions as both main themes are varied and developed, and then comes one last brilliant cyclic moment. Saint-Saëns brings back not just the themes from this movement, but also the first and second themes from the very first movement, combining them in an angelic atmosphere. The piano takes off in sweeping virtuosic scales that sound more like the end of a grand piano concerto than a chamber piece, a final reminder of Saint-Saëns' extraordinary skill as a pianist. Saint-Saëns dedicated this quintet to his great-aunt, Charlotte Masson, who was deeply involved in his upbringing and gave him his very first piano lessons, a fitting tribute in such a deeply expressive and powerful work. This concludes our discussion of Concert Program 4, Quintessential Quintets. A special thank you to Amy Cota for her immense help in procuring the audio samples, to the organizations who provided access to their catalogs, and to the artists who agreed to share their thoughts on the music. I'm Dmitrija Tappan.
And I'm Heyam Park. And on behalf of both of us, thank you for listening. We look forward to seeing you soon at the concerts.
Audio notes are written and produced by Dmitrija Tappan and Heyam Park in consultation with David Finkel and Wuhan. Many thanks to Paul Neubauer, Sebastian Mons, and Nicholas Kanellakis for speaking with us for this session. Audio excerpts are courtesy of the following artists and organizations. Mozart's String Quintet in B-flat major K174, performed by Sean Lee and Arno Sussman violins, Mark Holloway and Matthew Lipman violas, and David Rukiro cello, courtesy of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. Weber Clarinet Quintet in B-flat major Opus 34, performed by Anthony McGill Clarinet and the Miro Quartet, courtesy of Music at Menlo Live. Boccherini String Quintet La Musica Notturna delle Strade di Madrid, performed by Yura Lee and Stella Chen violins, Matthew Lipman viola, as well as Nicholas Kanellakis and Sihao He cellos, courtesy of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. Saint-Saëns Piano Quintet in A minor Opus 14, performed by Andrea Lucchesini and the Quartetto di Cremona, courtesy of Audite Germany. Audio Notes is a copyrighted production of Music at Menlo.